So, good evening, everyone. This is the next to last of our Wednesday evenings during practice period. Moving right along. And some of you, I think, have been able to dip into the Lotus Sutra a little bit on your own and get the flavor of the text, and some of you may have only heard the excerpts that we've been reading during our talks and classes, and some of you may be showing up for the first time and have no idea what the Lotus Sutra is. So it's a pretty long text that we've been talking about for these 6 weeks of our fall practice period, and it was compiled in the first or second century of the Common Era, five or six hundred years after the Buddha lived, and it came at a kind of key turning point in Buddhist history. Sometimes it's called turning of the wheel, the Dharma wheel. At a time when maybe we could say that monastic Buddhism had become kind of academic or cut off from ordinary people's lives. So it was sort of a reform movement known as Mahayana Buddhism, which made the Dharma, the teachings, and the practice accessible to a wider range of people, and emphasized what we call bodhisattva practice. Bodhisattva is, a bodhisattva means an awakening being. An awakening being who realizes that the importance of not just practicing to achieve a sort of personal freedom from suffering, personal nirvana, but the importance of practicing, continuing to practice to benefit others, so that all beings will awaken. And in a sense, that's really the true nature of our existence, that we awaken along with all other beings, because we are interconnected with all other beings. There's no way, in a sense, to do it alone. So that's the really deep message of the Lotus Sutra, is that we are all we can all take the path of the Bodhisattva to full awakening, the full awakening of a Buddha. We all are Buddha nature. But in reading this text, there's that wonderful kind of spacious message. But at times there are also there's also some challenging content, or at least there was for me. The text comes from a deeply patriarchal culture. And in the many stories in the Lotus Sutra, you may have noticed already, those who've been following this, there are many parables in the teaching stories in the Lotus Sutra. And they're all about men. Fathers and sons, male friends, kings, generals, soldiers, etc. And in the vast assembly that the Lotus Sutra describes coming to hear the Buddha preach, there are no female Buddhas or Bodhisattvas. There are heavenly kings, but no queens. And the Buddha's female followers are not mentioned until the chapter I'm going to talk about tonight, or one of the two. In the first half of the sutra, the only time women are mentioned is when laymen and laywomen are listed among the Buddha's followers. And that's not insignificant, that's very important. The Buddha, throughout the Lotus Sutra, repeatedly proclaims that all good men and women, or all good sons and daughters who embrace the Lotus Sutra will become Buddhas. So the message is more inclusive than it might appear. Tonight I'm going to look at three chapters that appear oddly inserted between chapter 11, which some of you may have heard the story of the great bejeweled stupa arising from the earth with many treasures, Buddha seated in it, and Shakyamuni Buddha sits beside him in the great tower. Between that chapter and chapter 15, in which myriad bodhisattvas arise out of the earth. It's quite a dramatic, these are two really dramatic chapters, and yet there are these three extra chapters inserted between them. And scholars speculate that these chapters were added at a later date. These chapters concern those who were left out of the first section of the Lotus Sutra, in which the Buddha prophesies or predicts that all these those present in the assembly, the arhats, the original disciples of the Buddha, the bodhisattvas, all these present will become Buddhas. These two chapters, or particularly these two chapters, concern those who are left out. Women and evil people. It's no coincidence that these two categories are placed together in these extra chapters. Because women were considered in ancient Indian culture to be more evil than men. Because of being more prone to desire and less able to curb their desires. This attitude can be found in Western culture as well. And it's really an example, I would say, of the human tendency to project one's own difficulty onto others. Or onto an imagined other. In this case, on a kind of a mass, collective basis, men projecting their own difficulty with strong passions onto women and seeing restricting women's autonomy, mobility, education, etc. as a solution. This pattern hasn't entirely gone away in our world today or in our own culture. In the Lotus Sutra, as I mentioned, the Buddha generously gives these predictions of Buddhahood to all those present. Not just the arhats, the original disciples and the bodhisattvas, but other monks and nuns who have entered the way, and even laymen and women. So this begs the question, what about really bad people? We do better to say people who do really bad things. Can even they become a Buddha? Are even they of Buddha nature? Are we supposed to see the Hitlers and the Saddam Husseins of the world as potential bodhisattvas? Or take your choice of any contemporary bad guys. Who is it most difficult for you to see as a Buddha? As a bodhisattva. To the Buddha's followers, it was Devadatta, the Buddha's jealous cousin. And that's who this next chapter is about. According to legend, Devadatta tried to kill the Buddha three times. Apparently, when he was younger, Devadatta joined the Sangha, and he was at first well regarded. But he became greedy for power, and acclaim, and tried to amass his own followers, his own disciples. It seems he became a kind of fundamentalist zealot, advocating really strict ascetic practices, more so than the Buddha did. The Buddha taught the middle way. He even made a bid to supplant the Buddha as the leader of the Sangha, which was rejected by the majority of the monks. This so enraged him that the legend goes he hired a man to kill the Buddha, and two more men to kill that man, and four more men to kill those men, and eight more men to kill those men. But when the first assassin approached the Buddha, he became afraid and he threw down his weapons and asked to become a follower. And the same thing happened with each wave of assassins. Devadatta's second attempt on the Buddha's life occurred on Vulture Peak. Remember, Vulture Peak is where the Lotus Sutra is said to take place, or the assembly in the Lotus Sutra. It's an actual place in India. Devadatta is said to have pushed a huge boulder down from the peak, which narrowly missed the Buddha and dislodged a smaller stone, which struck the Buddha in the foot and wounded him. For his third attempt, Devadatta apparently got a huge male elephant drunk, and the elephant charged the Buddha, trumpeting with rage. When it came near him, the Buddha reached out mentally with his compassionate mind, and the elephant came to a stop, and the Buddha spoke to him gently and petted him on his trunk. And the elephant was subdued. So Devadatta had a pretty bad reputation. Not only did he try to kill the Buddha, but he spread dissension among the Sangha. Most legends depict him as suffering in a burning purgatory after his death, but some accounts apparently say that he deeply regretted his deeds just before his death. However, the Lotus Sutra makes no mention whatsoever of his evil deeds, though they certainly would have been known by everyone hearing the Lotus Sutra. Instead, in the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha tells a story of an earlier lifetime in which he was a king, the Buddha, who was a king in his earlier lifetime, who abdicated his throne to seek the truth of the Dharma. He wandered far and wide, searching for someone who could teach him the Lotus Sutra. You've seen how the Lotus Sutra keeps cropping up in the past, as well as the present. Finally, he found a holy man named Ashita, who promised to teach him the Lotus Sutra if he would serve him, which he then did for 1,000 years. After which, Ashita kept his promise. The Buddha then reveals that Ashita was his jealous cousin Devadatta in a former life, and the king was himself in a former life. And that the great wisdom that he has gained is thanks to Devadatta in his past life. He then predicts that Devadatta will achieve full, complete awakening and become a Buddha. Immeasurable kalpas in the future. So we see that even the most reprehensible criminal of his time was not beyond redemption and had the capacity for awakening. The view presented here is that no human being is irredeemably evil, that there is a seed of goodness. There is Buddha nature in each of us. In this story, the seed is the good that Devadatta did in a former life. But we can see the seeds of goodness and most easily, just in this life, and most easily in children. Most easily in children before they become confused and conditioned by this world. It can be a challenge to see Buddha nature in some of the most harmful individuals we meet or know of. I recently read an article in the New Yorker about a woman lawyer who specializes in defending those who've committed capital offenses in the States. And most recently, and she's defended some really, you know, horrifically notorious killers. And the most recent case she defended was the young Chechen Muslim man who, with his older brother, set the bombs during the Boston Marathon that killed a number of people and wounded many, many others. And this was her first case that she failed to prevent him getting a death sentence. She'd been successful with all her previous cases. And though she is certainly no Buddhist, her practice in defending these extremely harmful people is to look deeply into the causes and conditions, the karma, that led to their actions, and to look for any seed of goodness within them, any seed of remorse, any seed of insight, and without ever justifying or minimizing the harm they've done, to argue against the death penalty. That's her goal in defending them, is not to defend them or prove that they're in any way innocent, but to argue against the death penalty for them. And I couldn't help in reading that of thinking of the Buddha. The Buddha himself accepted a notorious serial killer into his sangha. The serial killer was named Angulimala. A mala is, does anyone have a mala? A mala? Do you have a mala with you?
I have it today.
No, a mala is the prayer beads. Yeah. And Anguli means finger bones. He made a mala of the finger bones of his victims. And he decided he was going to make the Buddha his 100th victim. And he chased after the Buddha. And the harder he ran in chasing the Buddha, the more the Buddha outdistanced him. Until he finally called out, "Stop!" And the Buddha turned to him and said, "I've already stopped. You need to stop." And Angulimala had a kind of opening of his heart and mind and asked to become a disciple of the Buddha. And he was quite discriminated against, and the Sangha was afraid of him and angry at him, and so he took experienced a lot of abuse, and was very humble in practice for many, many years. The Buddha always accepted him, and he gradually became respected member of the Sangha. It's quite a story. That's another story. I should. But I thought of that story when I heard about this woman. So even if those who have done terrible crimes can be Buddhas, what about women? They're together in the same chapter. The Lotus Sutra first asks this question, what about women, in terms of a female supernatural creature called a Naga princess. A Naga is a kind of serpent deity in Indian and Southeast Asian mythology. If you've ever been to Thailand, you'll see Nagas. They're like serpents with kind of a dragon head. And when this word became translated into Chinese culture, it was often translated as dragon. Dragons are a little different because they have feet, and Nagas don't. but they're, you know, they're serpentine. And they live under the sea. So in the chapter, right after the Devadatta story, Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, appears, and he's just returned from preaching the Lotus Sutra in the undersea palace of the Dragon King. A Bodhisattva named Accumulated Wisdom asks him how many beings he has brought to the Dharma in his trip under the sea to the Dragon King's palace. And Manjushri replies, in language typical of the Lotus Sutra, the number is immeasurable, incapable of calculation. The mouth cannot express it, the mind cannot fathom it. Wait a moment, and there will be proof. And at that, countless bodhisattvas rise up from the sea, seated on jeweled lotus blossoms, and float in the air above the assembly. This is really kind of typical Lotus Sutra imagery. It seems even these great bodhisattvas were a little bit competitive. Then, Accumulated Wisdom Bodhisattva asked Manjushri if among those beings that he taught the Lotus Sutra, there were any who were capable of attaining Buddhahood quickly. Manjushri tells him about the 8-year-old daughter of the Dragon King, praising her. This is what he says. There is the daughter of the Dragon King, who has just turned 8. Her wisdom has keen roots, and she is good at understanding the root activities and deeds of living beings. She has mastered the Dharanis, has been able to accept and embrace all the storehouse of profound secrets preached by the Buddhas, has entered deep into meditation, thoroughly grasped the doctrines, and in the space of an instant conceived the desire for Bodhi, for awakening, and reached the level of no regression. No regression means kind of you don't relapse into your suffering and desires. Her eloquence knows no hindrance, and she thinks of living beings with compassion as though they were her own children. She is fully endowed with blessings, and when it comes to conceiving in mind and expounding by mouth, she is subtle, wonderful, comprehensive, and great. Kind, compassionate, benevolent, yielding, she is gentle and refined in will, capable of attaining Bodhi. So that's quite a tribute. But Accumulated Wisdom Bodhisattva is highly skeptical. If the Buddha himself took innumerable kalpas, if you haven't been here for earlier times, are huge, unimaginable lengths of time. If the Buddha himself took endless kalpas to attain Buddhahood, how could this mere girl be so advanced? At that, the dragon princess herself makes an appearance and bows down to the Buddha. Next, Shariputra, one of the Buddha's senior disciples, speaks up. He's also very skeptical. He says, "You suppose that in this short time you have been able to attain the unsurpassed way? This is difficult to believe. Why? Because a woman's body is soiled and defiled, not a vessel up for the law. How can you attain unsurpassed Bodhi? The road to Buddhahood is long and far-stretching. Only after one has spent immeasurable kalpas, pursuing austerities, accumulating deeds, practicing all kinds of paramitas, can one finally achieve success. Moreover, a woman is subject to the 5 obstacles. She cannot become a Brahma heavenly king. Second, she cannot become the king chakra. Third, she cannot become a devil king. Fourth, she cannot become a wheel-turning sage king. Fifth, she cannot become a Buddha. How then could a woman like you be able to attain Buddhahood so quickly?" The dragon princess then steps up to the Buddha and presents him with a precious jewel, which he accepts, and says, "I presented the precious jewel, and the world-honored one accepted. Was that not quickly done?" And they all agreed. Then she says, "Then employ your supernatural powers and watch me attain Buddhahood. it will be even quicker than that. So in an instant, she changes into a man and then becomes a Buddha sitting on a jeweled lotus. Witnessing this, countless beings were overjoyed and inspired to enter the path and receive prophecies that they too will all attain Buddhahood. The Bodhisattva accumulated wisdom, and Shariputra and the assembly silently believed and witnessed these things. So she showed them. But first she had to turn into a man. This was the conventional belief in ancient India, that a woman would have to be reborn as a man in order to achieve enlightenment. It was taken for granted in those days, and we can speculate that it was a part of an already existing story of the dragon princess when it was added to the Lotus Sutra. However, in the following chapter, there's no mention made of this condition, having to turn into a man. You may remember that the Buddha predicts that all of his disciples will become Buddhas. But in the earlier chapters, his female followers were conspicuously missing from this picture. In this chapter, in this next chapter, the Buddha's foster mother, Mahaprajapati, who raised him from infancy, his mother died when he was 10 years old, and this was his mother's sister, so his foster mother, and his former wife, Yasodhara. And his foster mother's name was Mahaprajapati. The two of them, who had both become nuns and joined the Sangha, appear and gaze up at the Buddha without speaking. He looks down at them and says, "Why do you look at me in that perplexed manner? In your heart, are you perhaps worrying that I have failed to mention your name among those who have received a prophecy of the attainment of complete perfect enlightenment? But I earlier made a general statement saying that all the voice hearers are those who heard the Buddha's teachings direct, that all the voice hearers had received such a prophecy." So he's kind of saying, well, you were covered in the general prophecy. But he does go on to make a specific prophecy for them, that they will attain Buddhahood. The story goes that Mahaprajapati, his foster mother, was the first woman to ask to be ordained into the Sangha, and that the Buddha initially refused her. It seems that he felt that the presence of women in the Sangha would be disruptive, and that giving women the freedom to ordain would be disruptive of the social order itself. It was the Buddha's longtime attendant, Ananda, who intervened on behalf of the nuns of Mahaprajapati. They weren't nuns yet, Mahaprajapati and the other women that she represented. Ananda asked the Buddha three times if Mahaprajapati could be ordained, and the Buddha refused three times. Finally, Ananda asked the Buddha straight out if women were capable of achieving nirvana, becoming arhats. The Buddha had to concede that yes, they were. But at that time, becoming a bodhisattva or a Buddha was out of the question. Ananda made his final pitch. He said, "If that is so," meaning if women can achieve nirvana, "if that is so, then since Mahaprajapati has been exceedingly helpful to the Blessed One," meaning to you, the Buddha, "when, as his mother's sister, she was his nurse, his foster mother, his giver of milk, she suckled the Blessed One when his own mother died. Since that is so, Lord, it would be good if women could obtain this going forth." So the Buddha finally relents and agrees on the condition and that Mahapachapati accept 8 special restrictions that applied only to women, which she did. And I'll just mention the first one. A nun who has been ordained 100 years is still junior to a monk who has been ordained for just one day and must defer to him and treat him with all the appropriate customs and gestures of respect. That's just the first, but there are other conditions that the Buddha set for women. And then the Buddha went on to tell Ananda that having women enter the Sangha would hasten the decline of his teachings over time. He said, "Just as when the blight called gray mildew falls on a field of ripening rice, that field of ripening rice does not last long. Just as when the blight called red rust falls on a field of ripening sugarcane, that field of ripening sugarcane does not last long. So too, in the Dhamma and discipline in which women obtain the going forth, the holy life does not last long." So with this background, maybe we can appreciate that despite some of the content that we find, that I found disturbing in the Lotus Sutra, that it actually did serve as a major turning point in Buddhist history in opening up the Bodhisattva path to women and recognizing women's capacity for full awakening. We don't know who wrote the Lotus Sutra, but most likely it was compiled over time from stories that were already being told and repeated orally. But as I've said, these chapters were added at a later date, perhaps from an awareness of what had been left out, what was missing. What about people like Devadatta, who had done really bad things? What about women? Someone wanted to make sure these questions were raised. Someone wanted to make sure that no one was left out. There's one more chapter that follows these two chapters, and it's a chapter of the Buddha's instructions to bodhisattvas, how bodhisattvas should practice. And he gives a long list of different kinds of people that bodhisattvas should not associate with: rulers and princes, people of the outcast, people who are outcasts, people of overbearing arrogance, monks who violate the precepts, nuns who are fond of jesting and laughter, widows and unmarried women, those who engage in harmful livelihoods, butchers, fishermen, human traffickers, those who engage in hazardous sports, wrestling, and other kinds of amusements. So this seems very might seem harsh to us from our present day standards, present day values. And yet when you consider the times and how he would have been aiming these words at young monks, it's maybe a little easier to see. It's not so easy to keep our own practice on an even keel in this world of distractions and desires. We could each make our own list of influences not to get hooked by. But let's listen to what he says a bodhisattva should do. Wrong book. He then says, that if anyone wishes to hear the Dharma, he should freely teach without fear. So even all these people to generally avoid if they wish to hear the Dharma. He says one should not speak in terms of superior, medial, or inferior doctrines, of doctrines of the conditioned or the unconditioned, the real, the not real. And again, one should not make distinctions by saying this is a man, this is a woman. Place yourself in quiet surroundings, learn to still your mind, remain tranquil, unmoving. Look upon all phenomena as having no existence like empty space, as without firmness or hardness, not born, not emerging, not moving, not regressing. Constantly abiding in a single form, this I call the place to draw near to. Set aside jealousy, hatred, arrogance, a mind that is fawning, deceitful, false, and constantly practice honest and upright conduct. Do not look with contempt on others or hold frivolous debates on the doctrine. Have pity and compassion on all. Be gentle and full of forbearance, never giving way to a negligent or slothful mind. So, this is pretty open and inclusive advice. Any of us would do well to follow. And to the extent that we do, to the extent that we can, practice as bodhisattvas in the world, our lives will be of benefit to others. We don't have to become big name celebrities to preach the Dharma. We can do it in quiet, everyday ways, ways that don't sound like preaching at all, but through the way that we live our lives. So this bodhisattva way is open to every single one of us. And that's the vision of the Lotus Sutra. So despite my sometimes struggles as I read parts of the Lotus Sutra, I had to pause over and over kind of to retell the stories in ways that resonated for me in my own life as a woman. And yet I gradually came to appreciate the Lotus Sutra vision of no one left out. No one left out. And how powerful it must have been in its time, how moving it was and remains to many people, this vision of no one left out over many years. And that led to our own Soto Zen tradition, Dogen Zenji, to say unequivocally that women, there is no distinction between men and women in the practice of the Dharma. I'll maybe talk a little bit more about that. There's some wonderful reference from Dogen Zenji about the dragon princess that I might we might talk about Dogen Zenji and the Lotus Sutra next week. But now I want to have a little time for you to talk with each other.